workshops, speakers, camping, and more. Again, that's the Cascadia Solstice Jamboree, June 12 through 14, outside of Husum, Washington. Specific event address and directions will be released 1 week before the event. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to Words and Pictures, the comics and animation show. I'm SW Conser, and we're here in the home studio of Philip Barish. He's the painter and the author of the hand-hewn comic series, and number 3 is just about to drop. So Philip, this is an entire floor of your home that's given over to music and art and sculpture and all kinds of other fascinating crossover projects.
Well, all those things are intertwined. So yes, there's no escaping that fact. This is a very creative space. And I have to add that I've had many studios over the years. I've been a working artist for really 30 years, but this has been the most efficient and loveliest space I've ever had. This particular configuration works really, really well for me.
So we are downstairs now. We are downstairs in the lower level, looking at your most recent work. These are a series of paintings that are going to be exhibited as part of a First Thursday exhibit coming up, but also they're going to be available for viewing inside a comic book, and this is the hand-hewn series. This will be number 3. Tell us how listeners can catch up with the series. What's been going on so far?
Okay, the whole idea of hand-hewn is that I'm very interested in what most people now call sequential art, what we would know as comics. And hand-hewn is basically the springboard I use to explore a lot of other ideas beyond narrative structure, as in point A to point B in terms of storytelling, and get into the whole notion of the exploration of the kind of physicality of materials and how they unveil themselves in terms of narrative structure. So I paint comics with light, fast paints on archival surfaces. These are very large pieces. They're 22 by 30, and they all eventually become a publication that I call hand-hewn.
So these can be buried underground for decades, like the Russian icons during the communist era.
Yeah, and actually, you know what? Icon is the word, because that is really pivotal to what I do. The original series I started with was a series of cards. They were colored plates, 3x5, in a box called Cornelius. And Cornelius is the springboard for everything else, because I created a visual language and a mythology from which I could extract narrative structure and turn them into comics. So icons were critical in terms of how I first approached this. One of the things I was concerned with, and this is not a criticism of a lot of comic book artists, but I was concerned about the fact that I felt that the visual component of comics was enslaved to the actual text, that they were subservient to the text, and I always felt it was a visual medium. So one of the ways that I was able to kind of remedy that as my own personal expression was to create a visual language first and then build a text around that.
With hand-hewn, there's almost like atmospheric stories going on that don't have the plot points of a classic comic book. It sort of reminds me of some of the experimental film of the 70s, some of the narratives that you have. It's sequential, and yet each panel is an artwork unto itself.
Yeah, and also I would say, bringing up the 70s, because this is also a huge, huge influence for me, were the first probably 20 issues of Heavy Metal. In fact, Metal Hurlant, which was the French version. And what was attractive to me about that is you had the sense that there was linear narrative. You knew that there was some kind of overriding arc in terms of storyline. But as a viewer or reader, depending on whether there was text in the story or not, it was really intriguing to be immersed in this alternate visual reality and then have to basically be part of that reality and move through whatever storyline you were given. To me, that was a real departure from what I saw as kind of conventional storytelling, particularly by American publishers. So heavy metal was a massive influence. Having said that, though, in terms of publishers, Warren Publishing Company, which did Creepy, Eerie, Vampirella, they did Famous Monsters, they also were really amazing in terms of really expanding what it meant to be a comic. It was really important to move beyond just flat storytelling from issue to issue and get into ideas about how the line is drawn, how the stroke is made, how the paintbrush is put down. So I also became very interested in the mechanical side of things. The actual making of the product became as important as the actual product that was produced.
You know, there's a low art, high art debate that goes on when it comes to comics. It kind of started with Roy Lichtenstein, or I guess it... It really got heightened with Roy Lichtenstein. But there's an art versus craft dichotomy that's so popular in the Western world, and you know, you don't see that as being such an issue, say, in Asia or Africa. But in the Western world, comics artists for so many years thought of themselves as craftsmen, craftswomen. And it's only recently that that the fine art world has kind of morphed over into the comics world. And you see, starting in the 90s, great painters like Alex Ross and Bill Sienkiewicz doing not just covers, but also entire stories with watercolor or oils.
Yeah. Well, and that what's really interesting about this whole kind of discussion is that one of the things that happened in terms of comic books starting to morph into a more respectable form is that they begin to shed the idea of just being available for the masses as far as a kind of a pulp thing, and recognize that what they had to say and what they had to do moved beyond the whole function of just telling a story. One of the other criticisms I'll level, which is legitimate, is that a lot of the giants of the comic world, particularly for me in the 70s, is that they were stunted in terms of not growing. Frank Frazetta is one of my very favorite artists in terms of his level of craft.
I think he's well known for the Conan posters.
Yes, and Conan posters, Ballantine books. He did Tarzan's. He moved into Hollywood and did posters. Yeah, Frank Frazetta is, he's really pivotal in terms of understanding like a singular image that defines a genre and or defines a movement. My criticism of him is that he became stunted, and although he was a very high level of craft and he understood himself as a genre painter, at the end of his life, he died, I think, at the age of 85 or 86, he was still doing amazing paintings. Don't get me wrong, in terms of the level of craft, I would like to have seen them be more informed by what it meant for him now to be 85 years old. And so what I'm saying is that comics, in terms of moving forward now, or sequential art, whatever you want to call it, is that it's much more interesting to see how the artist is informed by his life circumstances and his conditions, and how then is translated into what it is that he or she is doing, as opposed to using their craft to actually define or be dictated by some narrative structure. I like the idea that it moves beyond just the literalness of what is being told.
So it seems like, from what you're saying, genre comics are kind of following the evolution that happened to film genres. So back in the 50s, the 60s, with Cahiers de Cinema, with Godard and Truffaut and Antonioni, all of these genres like noir films started evolving into something a lot more sophisticated and nuanced. And probably in the last 20 or 30 years, you've seen it happening with comics, especially noir comics, getting a lot more nuanced, a lot more self-reflective and self-aware.
Well, not only that, but it also becomes the creation of a whole visual language. And embedded in that language is the idea of a mythology. I mean, this is another thing that's really important, is that there has to be underneath of these things the idea or the sense that there is some reality, there is some larger world, there is some other context that matters beyond the literalness of telling the story. And that becomes really increasingly more important to me, because if you don't have a mythology to build on, then it simply becomes kind of telling stories. And so the whole idea that you can create a visual language, create a new visual species, that becomes increasingly more important because it's within that framework that the artist then has enormous latitude to kind of experiment and move forward with their ideas, not only about storytelling, not only about character building, but also their ideas about making art, materials. It's materials, I think, is another really important thing to look at.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm S.W. Konser, and I'm coming to you today from the home studio of Philip Barish, whose comic book series, Hand Hewn, is coming out with its third issue. Okay, give me some specifics. How do you try to connect with your readers through visual imagery?
Well, I'm going to start first with the paint, because I think that it's really critical to what I'm doing. And I'll start first by saying that in a previous life, I worked at an art material store called Daniel Smith up in Seattle. And at that time, which was the late 80s and the early 90s, they were one of the few art companies that was actually developing whole series of colors that were organic synthetic pigments. I would call these mutant colors, because they don't have a counterpart in the natural world. And the thing about these particular colors is, first of all, a lot of them weren't even around 30, 40, 50 years ago, so they didn't exist, but they're also extremely light fast, they're very transparent, and they're very clean to use. Just as an aside, a lot of these colors were developed originally in the automotive industry, and they became so light fast and so versatile that they then moved into the art world and became pigments for painters' uses.
Well, I'm looking at your paintings right now, and the colors, they're not what you would call photorealistic. There's almost a dreamlike sense. They're just so intense. They're so saturated that they just sort of take you into a whole different psychic space.
Yeah, well, saturated is a good word, because first of all, there's a function of the actual pigments themselves. And like I said, they're very transparent, they're very clean, and they're extremely light fast. But also in terms of the way I use them in a series of glazes, which means taking a transparent color and laying it one over the other over the other. The effect is that when light moves through the top surface, it hits the backside of whatever my surfaces I'm working on, either the multimedia board or the clay board, and when it pulls it back, it brings all of these colors with them. So it registers as a single color, but it's made up of many, many different colors. And it just, there's an electricity to that. They're just very electric. They kind of like buzz.
It's really vibrant.
They are vibrant, they are.
And that's part of your stories too. It's, you'll see these individuals out in these landscapes, and it's really not telling you what to think or whether to have an opinion about this individual or the story or the odyssey that they're on. It's just kind of putting you in the space where you're following along with a character, and you can make your own judgments.
Yeah, well, another thing too that in terms of how I work is that we know what graphic novels are, and that's a really usable phrase. But I've decided to call myself a graphic short story artist. And the reason that I do that is that I can create these standalone series that, when connected, then become part of a larger story arc, but are not necessarily meant to be combined together to become what we would call a graphic novel. It's really important to me that they have the ability to be freestanding in terms of their ideas, their content, in terms of what it is that I'm exploring. But when you get three or four or five or ten or however many it is together, then there is the sense they're connected. And it's not a literal sense that, okay, if you put these things together, you're going to have a novel at the end. That could happen. But what's more important to me is that if you extract any one of these elements from the larger part, that they can stand alone, and when you insert them back in, that it's this larger body of work. And that's really very important to me.
So are you going for being the graphic novel version of Raymond Carver or Charles Bukowski?
Actually,
or something, where you're carving out a world in which several individuals are making their own way?
Yeah, actually, those are really good comparisons. Yes, I would say yes. I mean, another good example in terms of like the fantasy or horror world would be someone like H.P. Lovecraft. You know, a series of interconnected stories that function as alternate realities, but you know that connected, they all make up this larger Cthulhu mythos. But you can remove any one of them from the mythos, and they stand alone. So that is what I'm doing.
Let's ask you about one of your stories that you think is really indicative of the series, Hand Hewn, to tell our listeners about. Give us just a brief synopsis of one of the stories in Hand Hewn.
Okay, there's one called The Fwy, spelled F-W-Y. And so The Fwy is it's about a painter. And in the process of finishing one of his paintings, this fly gets caught up in the varnish, and so it's sealed into the painting. And in the course of the exhibition of the painting, it's no longer about the painting, it's about the fly. And so it removes him, the painter, his name is Terry Vert, it removes him from the equation because people aren't talking about whether or not he's a gifted painter, whether or not he matters, whether or not his stuff is great. It's the sense that in the art world, in Terry Vert's world, where he's creating a body of work that he feels is important, he becomes detached from that by this accident of this thing becoming embedded in the varnish of the painting. It may sound grim, but there's also some really funny stuff in there. There's some very broad kind of parody. There's a lot of satire. But underneath all of that, there's really some exploration of, you know, what it means to be attempting to create something and have this completely random act happen that then removes your ability to push any of it forward.
Well, that sounds like a lot of the tensions that have gone on in 20th century art and modernism and Art Brut and Dada is this tension between the organic and the artificial, between the organic and the material.
Because there is conflict there. I mean, one of my favorite filmmakers is Terry Gilliam, because these are some of the things that he gets into, the idea of the conflict between technology and the organic world, the natural world, the man-made world.
Another one would be David Cronenberg.
Oh, yeah. In fact, he might be a better example because he actually takes it a few steps further than Terry Gilliam. I mean, Terry Gilliam has a tendency to get caught up in kind of like the embellishments of the reality, where Cronenberg, I think, is really interested in dissecting the realities of these things. So yeah, that really does become very important in terms of like when you start looking at things, that there's the artificiality and the manufactured quality of things, and then there's just the erratic nature of the natural world, these things that come in and alter and play with and significantly change how we perceive things just because it happens.
And the artist can either cooperate with the forces of chaos or resist them.
Yeah, and I'll give you a great example. There's another piece I'm working on. It's called Cat Piss No Primer. And in fact, this piece over here, I'll show you this. My cat actually sprayed on this painting, okay?
It's got a very green and yellow element to it.
Yeah, well, and actually, when I was really angry. My cat backed up and sprayed on the piece, right? And it's like, I can't believe you did that. But then when I
put a signature on.
Well, when I step back and look at it, it's really lovely. I mean, there's a random pattern to it. There's this kind of just singularly wild element. I mean, the color of the urine, just the random spray pattern of the urine, and so I had to either accept it and be angry about it, or say, well, I guess I better work with it and turn it into part of the piece. And in the end result, I don't want to say I'm happy my cat did that, but it makes for a much more interesting piece because my cat sprayed on that painting. It's a lovely color, you gotta admit. I mean, that's some nice cat urine.
So right next to that piece is a real slice of life, urban landscape here.
Yeah, and these are interludes. This particular piece here, one of the things I'm doing with Hand Hewn is that instead of just going from story to story, I'm taking the idea of the old host, like the old EC host or Uncle Creepy or Cousin Eerie, which it was always nice to have these guys introduce the next story. Well, what I want to do is I wanted to kind of elevate that idea and say, why can't a single painting with its own ideas then be used as the means of introducing the next story? And in this piece, there's the fly from the story The Fly actually introducing the next story. And this single image stands by itself, but is also used in a very pragmatic way as introducing the next story. So in that way, I can really play around with my ideas simply about painting. Because it's a single panel, I don't have to worry about whether or not it's connected as a series of storytelling functions of panels. I can just let it do what it wants to do. And as a painter, I get to just paint.
And the narrative text there, the introductory text is written on a dumpster lid.
Yeah, oh, isn't it great? Yep. And Stanley, who's the dog, Stanley's my kind of mascot for hand-hewn, he's being petted by a couple of guys. And so the fly is simply saying, Stanley has never been able to resist a good hand. This bit of self-indulgence leaves him unable to introduce our next tale. I'll just wing it. Ladies and gentlemen, The Last Stall. And so the next story is The Last Stall.
And in the spirit of medieval and Renaissance art, you have characters and elements pointing to other elements that are important. The fly is pointing to Stanley the dog to lead the reader's eye in that direction.
Yeah, these are what you would call devices. And that's something else is that in terms of artists that I really, really respect, once again, getting back to comic book artists, guys like Wally Wood, you know, Frank Frazetta is another one. Steve Ditko was another one. Reed Crandall, any of the guys that worked for Warren Publishing, they understood devices. And so it's a real pleasure as an artist to say, it's a visual tool. I have this hammer, I have this screwdriver, I have this saw, whatever it might be, and I really know how to wield it. And so there's a great pleasure in being able to take the tool and use it in such a way that it actually moves everything forward. Not necessarily recognizable in that way, but just it's just a level of craft. Everyone enjoys a well-written book, a well-edited film, a great piece of music. It's about that level of craft, and that's something that I take great pride in.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm S.W. Conser, and I'm coming to you today from the home studio of Philip Barish, whose comic book series, Hand Hewn, is coming out with its third issue. So let's move over here. Oh, wow. So this is a piece that you've got up on your easel right now. You're in progress. This book is almost done, Hand Hewn 3, and you're in progress on the table of contents, it looks like.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I'm really enjoying is I'm doing all my own hand lettering. And I have to say that the first two issues of Hand Hewn, that I'm proud of them, but I just am not quite comfortable with the digital text that was dropped in. I mean, one of the things that's really important to me is to get the experience of something that's actually hand lettered. It's, in a way, it's one of the criticisms I have with CGI is that as amazing as CGI is,
computer generated imagery,
right, in film, is that you never get a sense of feeling the hand behind it. You know, it's not like when you look at a Bill Plimpton thing where you feel the hand behind the animation. So the thing about the whole kind of digital technology is that it's clean and it reproduces well and it looks good. But to my mind, I never get a sense of the hand behind it, A, and B, my brain never connects to it being a physical thing, that my brain always understands at some level that it's a virtual experience. And so I want to hand letter everything.
And in this case, you're integrating the text into the environment and wrapping it around elements of the picture.
That is true too. Yeah, I have the ability then to just actually really expand on the idea of what it even means to have text. In this case, the function of a table of contents is just to describe with a masthead the publication, where it's published, how often it comes out, that kind of stuff, and then also what's contained within the publication. I would like to just take that whole idea and really just stretch it as far as it can go. And that's what I've done. It's hand lettered. It's an actual oil painting. I'm missing information. I'm kind of making stuff up. I'm being very, I suppose, non-conventional in how I'm approaching what normally would have been considered to be a operational part of experiencing a publication.
It reminds me that some comics artists really regard text as being part of their art. The most obvious example being the author of The Spirit, Will Eisner.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, Will Eisner, I mean, he's an interesting case for many reasons. But one of the things about what he did in terms of, and he's actually revolutionary. I mean, he's, you know, you hear that term, but he's one that is actually revolutionary.
We're celebrating his centennial right now.
I didn't know that. Wow. Well, that's very cool. But one of the things he understood is that you have to incorporate the text and the images in such a way that it becomes a single experience. A lot of comics, the drawings are done, and then the text is dropped in. There's room left for the text. And we all recognize that. And yes, there's a function to it in terms of reading the story and looking at the image and then moving along in a sequential way. I mean, when, things like what Will Eisner did is that he understood that you want to combine those things into a singular experience. And what it does effectively is that it is respectful of both disciplines at the same level. It's the same, they're on the same playing field. One is not subservient to the other, that they both have the same weight, they have the same sense of balance, they have the same kind of democracy, artistic democracy.
So looking around your studio here, it's clear that you're a polymath. You have lighting setups for photography, you have sculptures, you have all sorts of found objects here. So what inspires you? I mean, you don't seem to limit yourself to one particular genre.
Right, and I don't think anyone would be served by simply having a singular vision. And what I mean by that is that you can develop a level of craft for a specific kind of thing, but I just think we all need to kind of live out loud. I think it's really important to like live creatively. It's really important to embrace as many different things as you can and move forward as an expressive human being.
So Philip Barish, thanks for inviting us into your home studio here today. And Hand Hewn Number 3 is it's going to be on the shelves soon.
Yeah, and also I'm going to have an exhibit at EcoPDX, which is it's a really interesting furniture store. They specialize in salvaged, embalmed, repurposing of all kinds of interesting woods, and they have a huge showroom across from the Russell Street Mac station. And there's a wall that is 70 feet long and 14 feet high that would accommodate my work beautifully, and that's the first thing I want to do. I need to get it up so I can see it. One of the things I've said over and over again, which I believe very strongly, is that the number one reason to have an exhibit is to see whether or not your ideas are working, that everything else is secondary to that. And I've reached the point now with Hand Hewn just about being completed that I now need to get it up in a space where I can look at it and study it and see what works and what doesn't work. And that particular wall is a really good wall to do that with.
I love the idea that in Portland, we can still have an art exhibition at a furniture store. It just seems to really harken back to our industrial roots.
Oh, yeah. And in this case, what makes it really like great for me is that I simply went in and asked them. And we've purchased stuff from them over the years. But the facility is amazing. It's like an 8,000 square foot room in an old warehouse with 14 foot ceilings, brick walls, you know, completely exposed. And it's like, oh, my God, this is the place to actually look at work. This is the place to actually do it. And so when I said, I'd like that wall, because what do you think about that? Brian was absolutely enthusiastic about it. He said, oh, yes, let's do it. We'll have an opening and get it up there and let's make this happen. So yeah, this is a great thing about being here, that these kinds of things can happen.
Well, where can listeners go to look at more information about Hand Hewn and about your exhibitions that are coming up?
Okay, my website is dancingchapmanstudio.com. And there's all kinds of, there's just stuff. And I just want you to know that I named my studio after my grandmother, Gladys Chapman, used to buy me art materials when I was a little boy. And so I named it after her. And there's a little dog on there. Stanley is the mascot of the studio. Stanley is actually a porcelain dog that she owned. It's been in our family for about 150 years now. And that's the Stanley who is the host of Hand Hewn, is that Stanley. So that's where Dancing Chapman Studio came from.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and our guest today has been Philip Barish of Dancing Chapman Studios and Hand Hewn. Philip, thanks for joining us. It's been a few years, and we hope it won't be so long before you join us again.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's an honor to have people following my work, and I also want to add a couple things here. KABU, support KABU. What they do is critical. It's critical to the community. It's critical to the health of all of us as a species. And the work that you do, Conch, I cannot say it enough, is as critical in terms of your little slice of KABU as what KABU does for the rest of the world.
Well, thank you, and thanks to all our listeners on the airwaves and on the web. This show will be available later online at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at wordsandpicture. Now stay tuned for an afternoon of music on your homegrown, hand-hewn Portland radio station.
And you're tuned to Community Radio, KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River, 104.3 FM Philomath.